again, friends, and welcome to another edition of 605, the Super Podcast. I'm the great Brian Lass, and with me, as always, the man Jim Cornette dubbed the Human Xanax, David Bixenspan. Bix, how you feeling today?
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out if the Human Xanax or the Human Quaalude is better.
Well, I think it depends on what decade. In the 70s, the Human Quaalude is better, but I feel like now Bill Cosby has kind of ruined that for society, so I would go with the Human Xanax. I think that works better. It hasn't been discontinued from the marketplace yet.
See, I was going to say historically, I would think that the Human Quaalude would sound more fun.
I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, historically, the Human Absinthe would be more fun. But, you know, it is what it is. We had a good time last week with our friend James Z back on the show. What did you think?
I thought it was better than the first show we did with him.
Yeah, you said that. You said that. It's hard for me to judge one versus the other. We definitely got a lot of cool stuff that I was very curious about, especially the early days of Randy Savage, the pre-WWF Randy Savage.
Yeah, I did not know just how bad off he was during the ICW era, financially.
Yeah, I mean, you always hear these stories about the Poffo family. You know, Angelo Poffo was the miser as his gimmick, which was a real-life gimmick. You always heard about how tight they were with the buck, even when Randy made it as a star. So, I'm very curious how much money they actually had saved up from all the years where Angelo was a star in Chicago and for all the years they had been around the wrestling business to the point where he was in that shape in 1982, 1983, and who knows how long before that, too.
Maybe they were trying to only live off what they were bringing in, or could, like, maybe they were had savings they refused to touch.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that, I guess. I mean, although you would think if you're at the point where you're sticking stakes in your pants, maybe that's a good time to...
That's true.
To go to the piggy bank. You know? I don't know. Do you ever have any run-ins with Randy Savage?
No.
I did. I had one. Oh. Did I ever tell you my Randy Savage story?
Maybe. Where or when is this from?
WrestleMania 10, backstage.
Okay.
So... WrestleMania 10, I'm 14 years old, and one of the guys who rented office space from my father had a booth at the Fan Fest. It was the first year of them having a convention aligned with WrestleMania. It was for the Friday afternoon, all day Saturday, Sunday, up until WrestleMania. Mm-hmm. And they had different booths with all these different vendors, and you could do like a picture or a video in the funeral parlor, and you could buy Coliseum videos from Hillbilly Jim, who I spent a lot of time with. He was the coolest guy.
Yes.
And he gave me like all these Coliseum videos. He's like, "Do you want them?" I was like, "Oh, I've been looking for all these old discontinued ones for years." Like, "I'll give them to you for $2 each." And I bought like every one of them, which was a real hassle carrying them home on the Long Island Railroad. But so I was there with this guy who rented office space for my father, Mark Cooperman. He had a company called Star Trek, and they did these pictures of The Undertaker, Bret Hart, and Randy Savage, where it was like a picture, and then the actual part with the wrestler, it was like a secondary picture on top of it. So it was like coming out of the picture was the picture. It's hard to explain. I'm not really doing a very good job of it, but
sort of like a lenticular image, but more 3D than motion.
Yes. Yeah. I guess that's a good way to put it. And he, I'd known him for years, and he would hook us up with garden tickets all the time. Like, because of him, I got like, you know, fourth row for, Roddy Piper against Rick Rude in a steel cage in December of 89. And I got like fourth row for Flair versus Hogan for the first time at the Garden. And he knew I liked wrestling. So now that World Wrestling Federation was a client of his and he was going to have this booth at the Fan Festival, he said, "Why don't you come and you could help us out in the booth and we'll get you WrestleMania tickets." And that's how I got, you know, whatever it was, fourth row for WrestleMania 10. And so I'm there and hanging out at the Fan Fest. And again, Hillbilly Jim, I got to spend some time with. I remember the 1-2-3 kid walking around zonked out on some sort of pill or something. And I remember Afa kind of watching me play around in the ring, which was a little scary.
Was he mouthing "not guilty" at you?
No, that was later in the year that happened. But then one of the things we wanted to do was get a wrestler to appear at the booth with us. And the three wrestlers that were on the products that Mark had were Bret Hart, The Undertaker, and Randy Savage. I didn't see Bret Hart around at all. I knew The Undertaker wasn't going to come out and do anything. And Randy Savage was walking around the back area of the thing, schmoozing with like different vendors and stuff all the time. So at some point I went over to him and I said, "Excuse me, Macho Man, would you mind, you know, coming out to the booth for a little bit and, you know, signing some autographs or, you know, just attracting attention to the booth?" And he looked at me and he just said, "Yeah, right, kid." And he walked away. I was like, okay, you know, he's a little bit, you know, standoffish. That's fine. You know, he would have been doing us a favor. That's fine. So then that was Saturday. Sunday, Fan Festival shutting down and everyone's getting ready for WrestleMania. So now where Fan Festival was ended up, it was like backstage of the Garden area.
The Madison Square Garden Rotunda.
Yeah. So it's now empty and we're a couple of the only people there. And some other wrestlers are there. That's where I got to meet and take my pictures with like Bam Bam Bigelow and the Head Shrinkers, who are all just like really, really cool. Bam Bam Bigelow wanted to talk about football because I was wearing a Giants starter jacket from the era. When starter jackets are really big and don't get me started on that jacket. Anyway, everyone was really cool. Every single guy we met was really cool. And then like me, Mark, and Mark's brother-in-law, who was with us, all at the same time had the urge like, man, before we go into the arena and sit down, we should go to the bathroom. We all have to go to the bathroom pretty badly. And we walk into the bathroom backstage where we are. And in the bathroom is Randy Savage, Crush, and Pat Patterson. And they're like, you know, standing next to each other talking about something. And as soon as we walk in, Macho Man turns around and flips out. And he goes, "You got to get the fuck out of here." And Mark Cooperman, like the funniest thing ever, Mark Cooperman didn't even flinch. He just grabs his dick and he goes, "Macho Man, we got to piss." And Randy Savage goes, "I don't give a shit what you got to do. You got to go." And he started like moving towards us. So like, okay, see you later. We left. And later on that night, we're sitting in the arena and it was the Randy Savage Crush. I don't know if it was a street fight or an alley fight.
The Falls Count Anywhere with weird Texas Death-esque rules.
Yeah, that's why I didn't remember exactly what the stipulation was. So it's Randy Savage against Crush. And when Randy Savage comes out, all three of us
are just... Can I say eth and not esque?
I think so. I'll blame it on the Xanax. When Randy Savage comes out, we're just standing up screaming at him like, "We gotta piss, you know, screw you, Randy." We're flipping out on him. No one knows what we're yelling about, but we know. And the match happens, and when the finish happens, we don't get to see because it's like in an
Madison Square Garden Rotunda.
Well, I go home that night, and my dad taped it for me on pay-per-view while I was at the event. And I pop in the tape because I'm a real wrestling fan, and I'm not going to go to sleep until I watch the event I just attended. And son of a bitch, Randy Savage pins Crush in the bathroom where he chased us out of. They must have been going over the finish in there. When we walk in just casually to go to the bathroom.
So and that was a bathroom?
That was the bathroom. That was the bathroom they kicked us out of. That was
why did they have rigging equipment in a bathroom?
I don't know. Maybe
because it was the finish.
Yeah. I really don't know. I figured let me try to use this situation to get some free tickets. I wrote a letter to Vince McMahon. And I was like, you know, I'm just a kid and I was, you know, at this event and Randy Savage and Pierre Clement and Brian Adams, because I was getting the Observer, so I had everyone's real name. I was like, you know, they use some very, very, you know, coarse language.
Wait, did you say Savage or Poffo?
I said Poffo. I said all three of their real names, and I sent it to him, and I never heard back. And, you know, now looking back, I should have sent it to Linda McMahon, and I would have gotten, like, free tickets for a while. But that's my Randy Savage story. I shouldn't say one time. It was 2 days in a row. But my one experience with him was just him really not being a very pleasant guy.
Funny how that works.
You got to get the fuck out of here. I'll never ever forget it. Mark Cooperman just going, "Macho Man, we got to piss." That just sent Randy Savage off. And the other guys, Crush and Pat Patterson, just stood there. Like, they didn't even move. They didn't even react. It was just Randy flipping out. So rest in peace, Macho Man.
That doesn't surprise me in light of the story in Bill Apter's book, among many others.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you hear a lot of things about his personality and his behavior, so I don't know. I really don't know. But
on the opposite side of the spectrum.
On the opposite side of the spectrum, we'll go from that to what do you got to talk about, Bix?
I wanted to briefly talk about Daniel Bryan, even though it's not quite within the wheelhouse of what we normally talk about on the show. I feel like thematically it sort of is, if that makes sense. So... I tweeted about it fairly extensively as it was going on and after, but I know you watch it even though you don't usually watch Raw, so I guess I'll start by getting your thoughts. I mean, what did you think, what did you feel watching that, etc.?
You know, I was like very conflicted because on one hand, it's an amazing, tender moment that you don't usually see on wrestling ever. It's one that could only be done in this era. You know, you couldn't see that kind of thing happening anywhere else at any other time.
Right.
On the other hand, I'm sad because he's actually one of the very few contemporary wrestlers I would always watch that I really, really liked. And, you know, this, I know what he's doing is for his best for the best for him, but it's all just so unproven. You know, that's, you know, the whole, like, he was trying to come back and he gave them his release and they didn't accept his release and they could hold him to his contract forever. And
not necessarily forever.
If he gets a lawyer, he can absolutely defeat that contract. It's a contract that wouldn't hold up in court.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was always kind of hopeful you would see him come back and see him wrestle Nakamura or see him, you know, wrestle some of these guys out there now. But, you know, I have to face it that he's not going to be able to do that, that he's doing what's best for him, best for his, you know, family. And it was a very special moment. I mean, there's very few moments that have ever been like that on their show. It was the Ric Flair retirement show. There was the Edge retirement speech, which was very different because that was at the top of the show, just kind of no notice. This was something they built up all day. Daniel Bryan will be announcing his retirement tonight. Tune in. And then everyone had to sit through 3 hours of crap until, you know, they finally ushered him out there. But one of the most genuine things they've ever allowed on their television show, I think.
And I would say even maybe on any wrestling show. I mean, it would be up there.
Well, in terms of retirements or anything like that, what other – can you think of any classic examples of a real moment getting on the air like that? I mean, one of my first thoughts, you know, it's very different in a lot of ways, but in some ways it's not, was the 1983 Terry Funk retirement in Japan, which produced this like incredibly real, visceral moment. Until he, you know, came back to wrestling right away. I was at one of his retirement shows in 97. But that moment, in that moment in 1983, that's one of the most emotional things I've ever seen on wrestling that just felt real. It felt like there was something really happening. The Ric Flair Nitro, where they brought him back.
Yes.
The Horseman brought him back. That's another one that ranks up there. You know, I mean, when you think about like Georgia Championship Wrestling or Florida or Mid-Atlantic, I'm really scratching my head trying to think of other examples like that. You know, it's sad that like someone like Ricky Steamboat, when he got to the point where he couldn't come back, although again, he later on did for a few matches.
That WCW just...
Yeah, there was no retirement.
Yeah,
there was nothing. He was gone one day and that was it. And he was a significant star, especially in what the WCW area was, you know, originally, which was Crockett Promotions. What do you think? Can you think of any examples?
I mean, I'm thinking about it, and I was thinking as far as the modern WWE ones, you know, Michaels did it very low-key by design, so it's different, you know what I mean? You can't really throw it in with the others. Edge was mostly everyone being shocked, more than anything. Flair, very emotional, but also very weird and conflicted feeling.
Yeah, and again, he came back right away, too.
And also kind of just a very oddly executed thing. Like, it was just like, it didn't feel like it was actually a tribute to Ric Flair. It just felt like it was almost the Royal Rumble. Like, here's Barry Windham.
Yeah.
Here's Tully Blanchard. Here's you know, Valentine.
And when I watched that, all I kept thinking was, oh, they missed. Where's Roddy Piper? Where's this? I was waiting for more people that weren't there, you know?
Right. And it just... And you know, Flair's crying also because he feels like this is forced upon him, but also in very different ways from, like, you know, with Bryan Danielson, he in the end he got to a point where he felt like he was making the decision, and I'm glad it ended up that way.
Yeah.
So I felt like in that sense also it didn't feel as, even under circumstances, it didn't feel as bittersweet and frustrating as it could have.
Yeah, I mean, I know our audience is a classic wrestling audience, and that's what the show is, but I would say if you're someone who doesn't watch contemporary wrestling, he is someone to go out of your way to watch his stuff, especially the stuff he did in Ring of Honor, where he was just incredible. He was creative. I mean, other than, you know, now knowing what we know, those Nigel McGuinness matches are pretty cringeworthy.
Yes, and when I saw people, like, on social media and forums talking about those and the Morishima matches... Like, as these fond memories, and like, in my head, I'm like, come on. Like, name any matches other than those.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this was just such a real moment. And just the little things that he, you know, the way I saw it put best was, it's like we don't really deserve him. I mean, he spent so much time talking about how much of where he is, like, in a very genuine way that you don't normally see, just because of the detail he went in about what the fans did for him, you know, and what wrestling did for him, you know, that wrestling brought him his wife, you know, in the end, you know, this isn't so bad. And the whole thing just very emotional. And I thought back even to also the whole thing where they did the Raw right after his dad died. And it was also like, it was like a similar but different vibe, because they did an angle to get him off TV right away where he didn't have to talk. But still, it was like they had his wife in there leading the yes chants. And it was like kind of like all the fans knew, even though no one was saying anything on TV. And it was just like this very like communal moment, I guess is the best way to put it.
Mm.
And yeah, I'm just, you know, if for people, you know, who haven't been keeping up with recent stuff, I mean, I would say, even if you're not that familiar with him, just watch the speech. And yeah, to get his appeal in WWE, I would say, and I don't mean to trample over you, even though, you know, you could argue maybe certain matches were better in ROH or whatever, I would say that to really get his appeal, watch kind of everything from once they decided that he was going to be in the WrestleMania main event 2 years ago through WrestleMania, or the night after WrestleMania.
Yeah, I'd say that's good.
That was because once they decided they were going with him, that was an absolutely tremendous program. I mean, that was the, you know, 2 years later, they've done nothing close to that.
No, that was a period where I remember telling you that I'm finally optimistic that they're doing some stuff right. I could watch the show, and, you know, quickly that ended. You know, Dave Meltzer told a story I think was really interesting. And it's about the first time he saw Bryan Danielson live on the King of the Indies show, that he was sitting with Red Bastien and Nick Bockwinkel. And they both went crazy over Bryan Danielson. And Bockwinkel went to Roland Alexander and said, "You better put this guy over in the tournament. This guy's a star." And what makes that interesting is that here are two guys you don't really think about as being of taking crazy bumps or doing, well, Red Bastien was a big bump taker in his day, but for the most part, you don't think of them as doing crazy things. And both of them ended up with what would now be considered the classic end result of too many concussions. And, you know, Bryan Danielson's going to now try to do what he can. He's 34 years old, not to go down that road. You know, it's funny. We talk about what other examples on classic wrestling there are in this. I was trying to think if there's anything from Memphis, and I realized every time there was anything touching or like that on Memphis, it ended in an ankle. It ended in someone getting attacked. That was the death of the Bruise Brothers and, you know, Eddie Gilbert crying for Tommy Rich to take him back.
Yeah,
every example I could think of something happening sentimentally on Memphis wrestling ended in a bloodbath.
Right. I mean, there are some exceptions, but I don't want to, like, include stuff that has to do with deaths. I feel like you could think, like, I think you could include, if you're thinking of Memphis, Doug Gilbert's first interview after Eddie passed.
Yeah.
Would be one. And then I was thinking Japan, and this is kind of a mixed one, because it was something that was already scheduled, I believe, but the Giant Baba retirement ceremony after he died.
Yeah, that's a good one, too.
Where it's, for those who haven't seen it, I think it was planned to be this way regardless. And then, I mean, then he got, you know, he had the cancer and he died, and I guess he figured he was going to last longer and, you know, would have time to do, you know, he would see it through to the ceremony at the Tokyo Dome. But it was, they brought out Bruno, and I think it was Destroyer and Kaniski, right?
Yes, that sounds right.
And Baba's boots in the babyface corner with Bruno, and they did intros for everyone like it's a match, and then, you know, they announce Baba, and the announcer's screaming and crying, and they zoom in on the screen with Baba's face, and the crowd just going nuts, and then, you know, Baba's wife just bawling after. I mean, that, I guess, because also it's a little different, though, because it's, you know, it's 4 months after he died, too, or three months after he died, so it's a little different, but that's one of the things I can think of where it's like, it's sad, but there is this more there is a positive slant to it.
Yeah. I don't know what else there is to say about it. Everyone should go out of the way and see it, because regardless of what you think about contemporary wrestling, it in and of itself is one of the great moments on American wrestling television ever.
And he himself is just a total class guy.
Yeah. I met him once backstage. Jim Cornette had me come to a Ring of Honor show in September of 2006.
The one I watched with you.
Did you?
On stage, yeah.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
I was actually going to mention that, and I forgot. Brian Danielson versus Kenta.
Yeah, Jim had me come backstage, and backstage in a room were, I think, me, Jim, Brian Danielson, Bruno Sammartino, and I think Gary Capetta was there for some reason. And I got to say hello to Bruno, and I got to meet Brian Danielson. I just told him, I said, hey, I've only seen a little bit of you, but everything I've seen, you're great. And he was just... to me, and I'm only a couple years older than him, and I'm, you know, he shouldn't care really what I think, but he was so humble and so nice, and it's something I always remember.
One thing before we move on, I did want to throw this in, because I feel like this just sums up him and wrestling and everything so well. Only time I've met him was 2 years ago at the WrestleMania press conference in New York City, you know, the Tuesday, I think, before the WrestleMania that he headlined.
Did he ask you if you had stayed out of jail?
No.
Okay.
And the way it works, you know, with the WrestleMania press conference, they didn't do one last year, but they have everyone just kind of making their prepared speeches at first, and then they do the red carpet type interviews after. It's not actually a press conference. They just call it one. And I'm trying to remember who it was. I think it was like they had him at one, they had the Bellas at another stop. One with Hogan, one with Cena, maybe one more. You know, all the mainstream media types there, your NBCs, whoever, are flocking to Hogan and Cena.
I love thinking about you on the red carpet.
Well, it wasn't really red carpet. This is at the Hard Rock in Times Square.
Okay.
The little room where...
the Hard Rock in Times Square, that's the former...
it used to be WWF New York, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think this is the area where that used to be the dance floor.
Okay, I know the room very well. I did some events there.
Okay, right. So, you know, around the room, they've got that. So anyone that was a wrestling fan, whatever they were with, you know, I'm with Bleacher Report. There's some people from a local Spanish station. You know, they all flock to him and stay there the whole time. And I'm going to read, the one quote, but, one of my favorite moments, just besides the way he acted. I mean, he treated he talked to everyone there just like he was just shooting the breeze with his buddies. And it's with him, you know, it's genuine too, which is cool. But the Spanish station asking him who his favorite luchador was, him saying Blue Panther and me unable to contain myself saying, I knew you would say that.
That's great.
So I don't remember what the question was and who asked exactly, but it was something about his connection with his fans. I just wanted to read this. There are like one or two things where it's in brackets to fill in, you know, whatever, him leaving out a word. But
sure.
The connection between me and the fans, you can't create it. I can't go out there and do something and tell you this is how you create this connection. You can't do that. It just happens organically. It's not anything that I did. It's just something that happened. If you've ever read Stephen King, his novels, I've never read any of his novels, but I've read his book about writing. And he talks about the process of writing. He essentially lets his brain take him where the story wants to go. It's interesting because that's just a muse. He worked hard at writing, but a lot of writers work hard at writing, and for some reason, they don't come up with the ideas that Stephen King does. It's not something that he has actively done other than keep writing. Same thing with me in wrestling. It's not anything that I've actively done. It just happened. There are a million guys who've worked just as hard as I have, who are very good in the ring, who are way better than me at talking, and stuff like this, doing media appearances, where there wasn't that connection, and you can't explain it. It's mystical. It's like the muse for writers. I think that sums up things well, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's really beautiful, actually. And, you know, he was someone who had an amazing connection with his fans, someone who treated it. I've never heard anyone say a bad word about him. And like I said, if you're not someone who's kept up with wrestling, his body of work is something to go out of your way to see. He's someone who would have fit into any era of wrestling and done well and gotten over as a babyface or a heel. Because even though he didn't really do that in WWE the way he did that on the independent scene, he's someone very, very capable of doing that. And again, one of the greats. I think he's a Hall of Famer.
Yep.
And everyone should go out of their way to see that. And I guess we should move on from talking about one of the nicest people professional wrestling has ever produced to maybe something else. I'm going to read Bix. Someone sent us a message on our 605 Super Podcast Facebook page, which you could interact with us or join the community on there, facebook.com/superpodcast. And this is from Matt Kovacs. Hey, guys, I started listening to the Super Podcast after Brian was on the Jim Cornette Experience, and I love it. I was wondering if you can go into detail about Moolah. What made her such a bad person? I've never heard a lot about her, and you piqued my interest. Keep up the great work. Thanks. Well, Bix,
that's Moolah a loaded not being, question.
Moolah not being a great person, I feel, is right in your wheelhouse. So I'm going to throw you a fastball and let you hit it out of the park.
Okay. How do I put this delicately? Or should I? Do I have
to? I'm already laughing. Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, there are two things that you should read to really get the full picture. One is an article on free-times.com, which is called Baby of Sweet Georgia Brown. Should be fairly easy to find. The other is Dave Meltzer's biography that he wrote for her in The Observer when she passed away, although that is not on the site, so you have to get the back issue from him. Because I think it's from 07, and the back issue's from the merger starts in 08. So, I'm gonna, I don't remember what was from where, so I'm gonna conflate the two. I don't remember which was from what article. The main thing to come away with is that if you were in her troupe of female wrestlers, you are expected to do certain things for men who wanted to do certain things, regardless of if you wanted to do them. And are you laughing?
No, I mean, it wasn't a laugh as much as just a incredulous chuckle.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I thought. Just making sure I wasn't hearing things.
No, I'm not laughing. That's not funny.
It's not.
That's not funny at all. No.
That's the bulk of it. There are other things too, like that she, in terms of the way she skimmed money from everyone and all sort and things like that, but that's the crux of it. And I've seen, like, I try to think about, like, this comes up Hall of Fame season usually, and people will argue that even if she wasn't a draw or whatever, that you can argue, you know, her, what would be the best way to put it, political manipulations or whatever in wrestling,
yeah,
make her a Hall of Famer. The thing is, it's like, yeah, there are a lot of people in wrestling who are bad people who are in the Hall of Fame. But if you're saying it's for her political manipulations, aren't you kind of rewarding her trying to kind of effectively forcing women into sexual slavery?
Yeah. I mean, now I'm laughing because I'm just picturing in my head, like, you know, oh, Velvet McIntyre, darling, go pay some attention to King Curtis. You know, just picturing like how this would happen. I've heard that charge before. I heard it before the Meltzer biography. She would sometimes come around Dennis's shows with, it was her and Mae Young, sometimes Diamond Lil. And there were certain rumors about things she had done in the past. And I mean, her political manipulations, basically, she stayed in the McMahon camp from day one of him broadcasting in New York in 1956, I think. She was on the very first television program he had in New York, as we talked about once before here on the show.
Right.
And she stayed in their good graces. She had a lockdown on women wrestlers in the New York territory.
I mean, she had a lockdown on them in most territories. I mean, it was, there were only a few that would use wrestlers other than her own, and it was usually more locals than from an opposing troupe like Mildred Burke's wrestlers.
Yeah. I mean, didn't she try to shut out like Debbie Combs and Cora Combs?
That sounds familiar, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have heard stories of her shutting out other women who weren't part of her troupe. And but yeah, I mean, I think if the question is why was Mulan not the greatest of people, I would say if you go under, you know, if she allegedly, I'll throw allegedly in there.
Allegedly.
Even though, yeah. Allegedly, she had her workers whose work depended on her getting them bookings, do sexual favors for wrestlers. That's
and promoters.
And promoters. Oh, okay. Wow. I don't know. You know, I remember reading something. I don't know if it ever came out. Wasn't Mad Maxine writing a book about her time at Mula's, I don't know if you'd call it camp or her property with
her
all
plantation.
The other – her plantation with all the other, like, female wrestling trainees and graduates who still lived on the property.
I think we had found it, and she had, like, a sample chapter up on her – on a website. There was, like, some – like, online magazine was running, like, a sample chapter for her, but I don't think she finished the book, or if she has, it's not out.
Oh, because it was really good, actually.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. And I'd be curious to hear what she has to say, because Mad Maxine was someone who – she appeared twice on Championship Wrestling, I think, in 1985, and somehow that was enough to get her in the original placements for Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling. If you look at it, there's a little Wendy Ricker cartoon, and there's a Mad Maxine cartoon. And she was quickly gone and replaced by Moolah on the show, coincidentally enough. And then I know she had a very, very short run in the UWF in 1986. But other than that, I think she was out of the business. So, yeah, I got to find out if that book ever, you know, whatever happened with that. We got to follow up on that and find out.
And she's got to have an interesting take on Moolah because, I mean, she is not a wrestling type, so to speak. I mean, she's an intellectual, you know, and she's – Mad Max.
It was incredibly well written, and she seemed very intelligent, and you know, it wasn't a very pleasurable experience. It was a very weird experience, it seemed, just being at that house, that plantation, and that's before anything else happened that, you know, destroyed her relationship with Mulah and that camp. So yeah, definitely something we have to look into and see if that book's out there. Bix, one other thing that was on our Super Podcast.
Yes, on a lighter note.
Yeah, on a lighter note. Well, we'll see about that.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Facebook.com/Super Podcast. Dean Jackson sent us a link. It's something I hadn't seen in a while, and I'm glad I hadn't because it was like I was watching it for the first time all over again.
Yeah, I feel like I must have seen this before, but I didn't remember it at all.
It is a jobber match from, what would you say this was, late 85?
I think it has to be late 85 because around the beginning of 86 is when Coco Ware against The Patriot. Not
the
Del Wilkes.
Not Del Wilkes.
Who are the guys in Amarillo that were the Patriots?
I don't remember.
Bobby Hart and someone. Anyway, none of those guys. Just
a generic mass job guy.
And yeah, I think late 85 because I think it wasn't too far into 86 that he went to Mid-South. Or I don't remember the exact timeline, but it maybe could be very early 86.
And Coco, for whatever reason, just beats the crap out of this guy on the show. Bix, I think you actually you have this video queued up so we could kind of talk over it for the audience. And as Bix has done expertly for the Jim Cornette stuff of him watching P.B. Diaz and Rock and Roll Roy Toy, Bix will have a video up so you can watch this along with our commentary by the time the show comes out. But let's get this going. Coco. The name of the video is funny too. Coco Ware absolutely destroys a jobber.
that's me because I took it from Facebook so we could sync it up and I put it on YouTube.
Okay.
And also keep in mind Coco Ware is a face here.
Yeah, Coco Beware was a I shouldn't say B, but Coco Ware was a big time face, and God, he was always great in Memphis. I mean, I've always been a fan. Him and Bobby Eaton is the Jet Set. I loved. I mean, that was great.
They weren't the Jet Set. The Jet Set was Bobby Eaton and George Goulas.
Oh, that's right. But I thought they called themselves the Jet Set too for a while.
Did they?
I could have sworn they did in like 82.
Okay.
I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that I'm pretty sure that there's a little bit out there where Bobby Eaton took that name and they used that name with Jimmy Hart.
Well, he had every reason to want to do that.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about George Goulas later on.
All right. So here we go.
Very, very Lance Russell-like with that introduction there, Bix. So now you see the Patriot in the ring, red mask, white boots, patriotic outfit, red and blue and white. And here's Coco, Coco just goes in the ring, a little determined. Everything seems kosher right now.
The Patriot seems a little nervous. This is probably his first match.
Yeah.
And then you see Coco, after having gotten his jacket off, and we're focusing on Coco for the first time. Coco seems very determined and is staring the guy down, and we lock up.
A lock up? He has Coco in the corner, a chop to the chest. Coco just comes back, and he's chopping the hell out of this guy in the back. And the guy's selling.
But he's working.
And here it is. Boom.
Oh, he my just, God.
He's knocked out. He knocked him out from that clothesline. And now he's waking like him up. The first thing this guy thinks when he wakes up is, I can't believe I'm doing this for $6. Boom. The guy was knocked. He knocked him out with that clothesline. That's
look,
incredible.
He is just, he's barely trying. He doesn't seem like he's even trying to sell at first. He's
Coco's
trying to figure
just,
out where he is. Look at this.
He's just throwing hard kicks to him like this is New Japan. This poor guy has no idea what's going on. Coco stomps on his back. Oh, and here comes the Ghostbuster.
Let's see. He protected him.
He didn't kill him on that as he could have, but right here. Boom.
I missed that earlier. He pins him by kneeling on his belly and in the middle of Jerry Calhoun's count, just slaps him in the face.
Oh, man. What did he do? I mean, he either called him the N-word or owed him money or said something about his mother or insulted someone else in the back or walked into the back and didn't treat people with respect or slept with one of the other guy's girlfriends. Or I mean, what could this guy have done? I mean, do you think it was anything in the match? I mean, all he did was lock up with him and give him one chop.
He seemed – Coke. I thought it could maybe be the chop, but Coco seems very focused and angry before the match starts.
Coco, at the beginning of the match, is like circling him and eyeing him like, you know, a 6'6", you know, like heel terror, not like, you know, babyface Coco Ware. And boy, it's one of the hardest clotheslines you'll ever see. And those rings in Memphis were hard. So when he takes that fall after the clothesline, when he takes that bump. That's not a bump. That's just a fall because he's out cold by that point. Yeah.
I feel like I've seen stuff like this, but outside of Steiner Brothers matches, I can't think of any of them where it's a babyface.
Steiner Brothers rough people up excessively. This looks like Coco really wanted to hurt the guy for like, you know, he was determined to show him something.
Yes. I mean, this is... Wow. I'm trying to figure out how we find out about this.
Well, is Coco out there? Can we get Coco on the show?
Maybe. I mean, he's currently being sued by WWE, so I don't know if he's talking to anyone.
Well, we could tell him that we will not talk about his concussion lawsuit.
We will talk about him.
Which he hasn't even filed, right? They're suing him before he sues them, right?
Right, because they sent the letter of representation about him, Blackjack, Dynamite, and Koloff.
Okay. Yeah, maybe we tell him, look, we don't want to talk about anything after 1986. Anything after you left UWF, we don't want to talk about.
Right.
We just want to talk about 1978 to 1986.
Including giving this guy a concussion.
Including what happened here. Watch this video with us and tell us what happened here. Man, I got to say, though, I like the look of the studio there. The black background and the...
This is what, right, this is when they have the CWA logo. So I like this era of Memphis in terms of the look.
Yeah, this is like when they would begin the show with the Eurythmics. And,
you know, like, oh, it's with the Diodato version of the song?
Oh, maybe. But,
yeah, I think so.
Anyway.
I don't think they ever used anything by the Eurythmics. I think it was always some version
of 2001. They would do that.
Oh, then it would go to Lance, and then they would play Would I Lie to You under the video of the wrestlers being on the show. That's right.
That's right. Would I Lie to You, Bix?
No.
Anyway, that is Coco Ware absolutely destroys a jobber on Memphis TV. With this and the Fabulous Moolah thing, once again, I'm going to make you tired of this, but facebook.com/superpodcast if you want to get on with the show and recommend things we talk about or bring up things other people have recommended things they want us to talk about. We will get to them in the days and weeks to come.
Yep.
So I had something I wanted to read on the air.
Yes, I'm very curious about this.
Yeah, so... Jimmy Snuka has been in the news lately. I don't know if everyone's heard, but he murdered his girlfriend in 1983, allegedly. a trial will be happening soon. And
or maybe not. We'll see what happens.
Well, where are we now with that? His defense team is saying that he is suffering from dementia to the point where he couldn't actually defend himself. Is that the argument?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know. Here's the thing. Watching Jimmy Snuka interviews for so many years, I think any lawyer who met him could argue that he's always been suffering from dementia, just based on the way he communicates and everything. So I don't know. I remembered that I had this article that Scott Cornish, friend of the show, mentioned last week here, sent me in 1998. And the name of the article is "From Fiji with Love Comes Superfly."
Oh boy.
By a writer named Bud Poliquin, I want to say. And again, it's from 1998. And it is about an independent show that'll be happening upstate New York featuring Superfly. And for this, I'm going to try to do a really bad Jimmy Snuka impression when I read his quotes. Let me see. Can I do it? Hello, brother. Well, I mean, it's easy to say brother, but other than that, we'll see if I can.
Well, you got to warm up a little bit. Say at 1027 on your radio dial.
A Superfly on your radio dial. She hit her head on the side of the road.
And also, okay. Of course, those are some real good memories, brother.
Yeah. Well, the quotes in this are something that cracked me up when I first saw it, and it made me think of it, so I wanted to read it again. From Fiji with Love comes Superfly. The voice is part whisper, part rasp, and all very friendly. Kind of like a South Pacific breeze. And the words? Oh, those. Ask Jimmy Snuka. Make that the Superfly Jimmy Snuka a question. And you pretty much receive a magnificent jumble of mystical yammering that might be considered serious baloney even in Fiji, this man's confessed place of birth. Appreciation and paying attention is the most valuable thing to get you there, brother. Jimmy responded to an inquiry about, well, I forget now. To get there is another thing coming upon that. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's my whole true fitting on the subject, brother. If you care, there's a spirit. And if there is a spirit, then you got the faith in something. Uh-huh. The Superfly in New Jersey at the time, rather than in a tide pool, did willingly come into the telephone the other night, Give him that. And with his pending descent upon Syracuse on his mind, he did share a bit of his philosophy. Brother, slow down, Jimmy said. You're way ahead of my brain. All I need to know is that when I get in there, I must be there and beware. Yeah, the Superfly is coming to town, and he's coming for two grand reasons. One, he's planning to kick some sorry creep's butt. And two, in the process, he's going to help raise money for the Mercy Flight Central, Central New York's nonprofit 24-hour helicopter ambulance service. This will simultaneously take place at the state fairgrounds between, well, we don't have to go over where the show was. Now, you should know this much about Friday's card, whose tickets cost $15 and $9. Unlike the WWF, which has become an R-rated organization complete with phrases usually scrambled on the walls of bathroom stalls, the USWF is more family-oriented. Oh, these guys will chew on each other's ears and swing the occasional handbag. But afterwards, they won't stand in the middle of the ring with both a sneer and a full grip of their manhood. Indeed, this will be professional wrestling the way it was meant to be. That is, full-grown men in their tights and feathers throwing business associates off turnbuckles. And it could raise a buck for a worthy cause. Our profession is the greatest thing in the world, brother, Snuka said. Professional wrestling will always be. It will always be. While there may be some pencil neck geeks out there who would disagree with Jimmy's view, preferring, oh, the theater, or art, or the symphony to the blue-collared ballet that could be found inside the celebrated squared circle, the fact of the matter is that the Superfly has provided his fans with some memories. This, even if he has chosen to be particular with his recollections. Question, what has been the highlight of your career? Superfly?
My most memorable night, brother, was when I wrestled in Madison Square Garden and I dove off the peak of the world and was still flying.
When was that?
Brother, you'll have to find out for yourself. I'd rather not mention names.
Question, but you came into the ring from an exceptional height?
That's the question I'm still trying to answer, brother. But it's lovely.
I'm sorry. The story is that Superfly Snuka was born on Fiji Island's 800-plus islands, on one of Fiji's 800-plus islands, that he grew up to be a cliff diver of renown. While that job did yield the odd pearl, it did not consistently provide three squares a day. So Jimmy turned to professional wrestling, where he made his name coming in high and often. Well, that's funny. Coming in high and often, and with his long black hair flying from the top rope. Hence, the Superfly, who claims after all these years, and he was not about to admit how many, to be the world's greatest wrestler. Question. So who's number two?
Brother, nobody is number two.
If you are number one, why didn't you ever wrestle for the belt?
In your heart, and everyone else's, you know. And you want to know why, brother? Because you know I love you, and all I needed was the spirit, brother.
Question.
Huh?
Superfly.
Brother, you better get on the phone and let the people around the world know that I'm talking to you. I didn't wrestle for the title, brother, because I never really needed it.
The voice was part whisper, part rasp, and all very friendly. Jimmy Snuka headed for Syracuse and a top rope at the fairgrounds, has offered his baloney, thick as usual, and a conversation needed to end. It was time, after all, to concentrate on Friday's match. So many creeps' butts to kick, so little time. And that is from Fiji with Love, come Superfly.
What?
And I definitely think the best part of the article is this quote is just amazing. Ask Jimmy Snuka a question and you pretty much receive a magnificent jumble of mystical yammering that might be considered serious baloney even in Fiji. That is great. So, that's the Jimmy Snuka article that I just had to read on the air.
Wow.
Fix, you all right? You're
I'm
wake
not
up.
Sure.
he dove in from a long distance. My most memorable night, brother, was when I wrestled in Madison Square Garden and I dove off the peak of the world and was still flying. Just the way his brain works is amazing.
Are we sure it ever did?
Yeah, well, I don't know. You know, at some point in this thing, I guess you could have had, you know, cocaine is a hell of a drug, that famous Rick James line.
Yeah, I mean, when you were telling me you had a Jimmy Snuka article, I was thinking it was going to be the one from Syracuse, from 83, right after the arrest for the initial public domestic incident with Angie.
Oh, the one with the dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. no, this one's much more lighthearted. No assault is brought up.
What about Syracuse, he's asked. There's little hesitation in Snuka's response, but little explanation either. A bunch of bull, brother, he says softly. A bunch of bull. The hotel manager got a little excited.
Oh, yeah, it's his fault.
Yeah, there was some excitement. The cops just didn't give me a chance to explain. They blew it up, brother.
Oh, boy, yeah. The cops framed Superfly. Yeah, okay. The only person he didn't blame was George Zaharian. But anyway.
And there's more, though. There's more when they get past that. We used to dive off cliffs in the Fiji Islands. We'd challenge each other. Who would go higher and higher? That's where the Superfly came from. Did he go the highest? Oh, yes. He smiles. Definitely. Always higher.
Yeah, well, again.
I never was a loser. It's... What? It's guts, brother. I thought it said it's guts. Whatever, a lot of dollars have gone through his pockets, and there are a lot of miles on his wrinkled forehead. That's one way to put it.
And that's 1983.
Yes. Miles? "Brother, I'll leave that up to you," he says. "Tomorrow, it's Montreal, then it's New York, then it's New Jersey. You figure it out." Figure out what? Home is Hawaii or an apartment in Connecticut, whichever is closest. "I've gotten better and better. These people have to be able to believe in your ability and believe in your sport. I love it all. There's something new and different everywhere I go. It's nice to listen to new languages, meet new people."
Man.
I sound like Jimmy Fallon's leather vendor character from Saturday Night Live.
It's just amazing. It's really amazing. It's funny, when you bring up cliff diving, it kind of makes me wonder how many concussions you think he would have had from that even before he got into the wrestling business.
I don't know. That's a good question, actually. And then now, I don't think we have enough time to read this, but are you familiar with the infamous Hawaii promo from 85-ish?
Not sure.
I've never seen it. I've only seen a transcript.
It's funny. I was just thinking about it. I won't do this one this week, but there's a transcript of when he won the 1983 Wrestler of the Year from the World Wrestling Federation, mm-hmm. and he did this interview that's just out of control. And then, of course, there's the famous one where he was on TNT right after the Piper incident. And again, reading the transcript, it's one of the funniest things ever. You just will stop and just laugh your ass off because he's just nothing he says makes any sense.
This one's really long, the thing where it's Ripper Collins interviewing him, and he's I don't really know how to describe it. It's peak Jimmy Snuka, though.
Oh, I did see this. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Where he just doesn't say anything, and then during his next match, like minutes later, Ripper Collins is like, "I want to tell the fans Jimmy Snuka was talking in his interview there, and in plain simple English, what he was telling the whole world is, Jerry Lawler, you're coming to Hawaii, to my Polynesian land. I'm going to kick you from post to post and pillar to pillar and take that belt back."
Yeah, it's always good when someone has to do your promo for you.
Yeah, like Brody when he was booking in World Class, and he's like, so what Dingo was trying to say is...
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, moving along, I do want to say we brought up last week that we have a Super Podcast Amazon link. It is tinyurl.com/605Amazon. And if you would... for your Amazon purchases, please use that link, and Bix and I get a little bit of a kickback. Help support the show. You know, we're not making any money with it, and we are pouring a lot of time into it. So just every little bit does really help. So it wouldn't cost you any more than it normally would for any of your Amazon purchases. So if you just use that link, tinyurl.com/605Amazon, and anything you put in your cart after you use the link, we will get a small amount for. So please do so. And on that topic, we do have a book recommendation of the week, which you can get on Amazon, and you can use that link that we just gave you. And I thought it would be pretty timely, Bix, for this week, for the first book of the week recommendation, to recommend Hitman, My Real Life in the Cartoon World of Wrestling by Bret Hart. Came out years ago. It is maybe the best book written by a wrestler. I think it's extraordinary. I love that book. To think that's the short version, that, you know, the version that he finished.
It's three times as long.
Yeah, which I would kill for that.
I mean, the era that we are in, he really should release that as an ebook or something if he can.
I'd buy it in 2 seconds. Yeah.
I mean, really, because it's already so detailed. You know, the thing that makes his book very different from a lot of other wrestlers' books is he started keeping audio diaries that he did on like a microcassette recorder from, I think he said, it, I mean, he had his good recall anyway, but I think he started doing that around the beginning of his WWF run, maybe even a little before.
I think so. I thought it was right around the time his run started, but it could have been before.
Right. And it covers everything that you could ever think of or not want to think of.
It's, like you said, it's amazing in its detail, and you get Brett's recollections of things that, you know, you would never think, like, oh, I wonder what Brett, no, like the time when David Schultz got fired, the whole incident where he went after Mr. T and had a, you know, was wrestling around with Hogan in the dressing room. You get to read Brett's version of that. You know, we talked a lot last week or 2 weeks ago about Archie Gouldie, the Stomper. And you get to read Brett's recollections of growing up there in Calgary with the Stomper was the top heel star. And Brett was eventually the top star in Stampede. And it is, you know, I feel like everyone had to have read it by now. But if you haven't and you're a Bret Hart fan or even just a fan of that era of, you know, the 80s into the, you know, mid 90s, it is extraordinary in its detail. And, you know, it's also it's an easy book to follow. If you say, I wonder what happened in 1983 or I wonder what happened around the time of WrestleMania 3, you can go there and have him. You don't have to worry about there being anything factually inaccurate. He did a great job with this book.
There's like one or two things, and they're very weird. The whole the Mike Von Erich thing where Mike Von Erich dies twice. There's that. But otherwise.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Otherwise, it's very accurate. One thing I would say for people to look up, if you want to get a taste of it, if you've never read it, but I mean, you should just get it anyway. Go put into Google and you'll find it immediately. Bret Hart, Too Poor for Real Pants. And you'll find a series of message board posts from Kendall Shields that I compiled years ago, where he posted his thoughts as he was going through the book and some select quotes and all that. And if you will get a taste for the book and why it's great if you've never read it. And then if our recommendation isn't enough, read that and you will want to get the book immediately.
That's right. Once again, tinyurl.com/605Amazon, and the book is Hitman, My Real Life in the Cartoon World of Wrestling.
And we'll also put a direct link in the show description.
That's right. It'll be in the show description, and we'll do it on Twitter and on our Facebook page. And on the topic of wrestling books, Bix and I had an opportunity to speak with someone who I really wanted to get on the show, and it's Scott Teal. It's a name that's come up a few times, as I'll say again in a few minutes on the recording of the conversation we had with him. Scott does a great job, and that's why I wanted to have him on the show. Besides the fact that he has great stories, his books on wrestling are some of the best out there. The Ole Anderson book, even if you don't like Ole, is an amazing book. The Stan Hansen book is really, really good, and I don't feel I hear enough about it. The Assassin book was a book I loved. The J.J. Dillon book, another amazing book. Every book he's been a part of, I've never read something that Scott has published that wasn't excellent. And I wanted to have Scott on to talk about his book because this being a podcast that deals with classic wrestling, I want to make sure that these stories get out there. I want to make sure that these books and the publishers of these books are supported so that they keep doing the work that they're doing. And with that, we're going to begin what is a two-part interview with Scott Teal. Today, we're going to focus more on his book company, Crowbar Press, and how it got going. And next week, we'll have more. But here is part one of Bix and my conversation with Scott Teal. The name Scott Teal has come up several times in recent weeks here on the program. When Jim Cornette was on with us, we discussed our excitement that Scott had recently re-released the great classic book, Whatever Happened to Gorgeous George. And when Bix and I had gone over the famed history of locker room ambushes and shoot Memphis TV live brawls, and talking about the stories of Dandy Jack Donovan and Mario Galento, Scott's name also came up as we recanted some of his great work covering these stories in the past in his newsletter, Whatever Happened To. And we're very happy to have with us today here on the program, Scott Teal. Scott, how are you today?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
We're doing all right. There's so much I got to ask you about. And I guess before we really get into it, I want to talk a little bit about Crowbar Press. You have this book company, Crowbar Press, and you've put out some of the best wrestling biographies and autobiographies out there, from Ole Anderson to J.J. Dillon, The Assassin, Stan Hansen, Don Fargo, which is a wild book, and Tony Atlas, as well as the aforementioned Whatever Happened to Gorgeous George. Tell me a little bit about Crowbar Press and why you started it and what you're up to.
Well, I got into wrestling back in 1968 and started watching it and started writing for magazines, taking pictures of the matches in Florida. Moved up to Tennessee, went to work for Nick Gulas. As I got more and more into wrestling, actually back in 1969, I discovered microfilm at the library, and I found out you could go back and look up old wrestling articles, and that's where my love for the history came, and I started doing the – I got out of wrestling in 1980 when Nick Gula sold his promotion, and I thought I was done with it forever. And then in about – I think it was 96, I started doing the Whatever Happened To. I just – some guy put on a convention here in Nashville, asked me to help him with do a program because I had a computer. Nobody had computers hardly back then, but I had one. And so I created a program, and – everybody I talked to kept saying, whatever happened to so-and-so, whatever happened to so-and-so. And actually, the Whatever Happened To newsletter, the title came, the idea for me even doing it, now that I think about it, was from Dick Steinborn. He talked to this event promoter, and the guy hadn't been in touch with me yet. And Steinborn asked him, he says, whatever happened to Scott Teal? And of course, the promoter says, I don't know. He says, I know he's in the area. Well, that's where that newsletter came about, was Dick Steinborn saying that, asking where I was. And so I started doing the newsletters where the wrestlers were giving in, you know, doing interviews. And that led right into the books. Ole Anderson was the first actual full book that I did. A lot of people seem to think Crowbar Press is this big company in a big building somewhere, but actually it's I've got a little office in my home. I work at my desk here. It's just it's not really a big company. It's just something I called. I had to actually, you know, start a business and register as a business, and so I called it Crowbar Press. But it's not really a big company or anything like that. I do everything right here. I have two little computers right here with monitors and printers, do my work here, and I do everything with the books, from rewriting or, you know, sometimes the books are done several ways. I may either do an interview with somebody and then I write the book, or they send me a book that they've written and I end up rewriting it, or in some cases they send me the book and I do have to do very, very little except, you know, maybe fix some grammar and do some editing. But that's pretty much where Crowbar Press came from, is just out of the Whatever Happened To, which, as I said, was sort of the spurred on by Dick Steinborn's comment to that event promoter.
I was a big fan of Whatever Happened To, and I was a subscriber as a teenager in Long Beach, New York. I was getting Whatever Happened To, which I know back issues are available at crowbarpress.com. And because of Whatever Happened To, I was able to, as a teenager, become a pen pal with Lord James Blears and also harass killer Carl Cox at home. So, so I was a very big fan of and in fact, I remember I wrote a letter in there once asking you, pleading with you. I said, please do a special issue of just Nick Gula stories, just Jack Pfeffer stories. And by the way, Whatever Happened to Chris Colt? And those are all things I still want, you know, to this day. So so please get on that.
You won't find a whole lot of that stuff because, you know, Chris is gone. I wish I'd been able to talk to him before he died. But so many of the guys are gone, and that is a problem. You know, we've lost so many of them. But, yes, I that's one of the reasons I did the Whatever Happened To. I used to put the wrestlers' addresses in there. They were all, you know, I always got permission first, and a lot of times I had their phone number in there, and they were happy to do it. A lot of them just got a big, big kick out of hearing from people like yourself, because so many of them had been out of wrestling for, at that time, probably 20 years, and they had been pretty much sort of forgotten. You know, nobody ever contacted them, and to hear from people like yourself, and I don't know, they loved it. Billy Wicks used to tell me all the time, he still gets letters to this day once in a while from fans who read Whatever Happened To, and they absolutely love it, because it's just like, you know, they're not forgotten, and that's the main thing. They didn't want to be forgotten.
The one wrestler who I remember didn't put his phone number or address in there was Ole Anderson, so you know, which makes sense, I guess. You know,
I don't remember doing a Pete. Did I do one on Ole?
Absolutely.
I don't think I. Oh, I know what it was. I did that on Ole. I did the. He just told some road stories, but I don't think I didn't do a regular interview. Did I?
I thought you did. I could swear you did. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, it was a long time ago. But
yeah, I don't think I did. He used to write. In fact, I don't. I'm trying to think if he wrote those road stories for Whatever Happened To after we published the book. But either way, in fact, that's how I think it was. When we published Ole's book, I was still publishing Whatever Happened To, and he wrote road stories for it. But I never did a full-blown interview with him in that.
How do you get to know Ole? Because I know, you know, it's always been said, and Jim Cornette's always said, that Ole really hated Tennessee wrestling. And you obviously were so aligned with Nick Goulas and his promotion. You were there for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years you worked with Nick. How did you first get to know Ole? What was the process of doing the book like?
Well, I had met Ole, I believe, back when he came into Chattanooga for Nick. Him and Ole and Stan Hansen came in. But I barely remember it. I mean, it was just, hi, I'm Scott, how are you, and blah, blah, blah. Then somewhere along the line, I was, you know, I knew Bill Bowman for years and years. And I was going to the Gulf Coast reunion, and one year we were both going to Cauliflower Alley Club in Vegas, and he says, Ole Anderson's going to be there this year. I want to introduce you. So I said, great. So he introduced me there, and there's a sort of a sad but a funny story. We went to eat, Ole and Bill Bowman and his wife Ann, and we're in this, you know, one of these big resort hotels, and we're in the the restaurant. And Ole being Ole, he's holding court and telling all these stories. But the problem was, he's using F word here and GD this and blank that. I was cringing because all around us was people with families. And I'm, you know, and I couldn't say anything to him because I just met him. You know, I mean, years later, he'd do that and I'd get on him. In fact, it got to a point where he'd curse or something, and he'd look at me and say, I'm sorry, I know you don't like that. And I said I don't, but that's, you know, you do what you got to do. And but it was, I was just crawling under the table at the thing. So anyway, he came to the Gulf Coast Ole came to the Gulf Coast reunion in the years that followed, and I believe it was the year after Vegas. We were all in my motel room there. All the wrestlers used to go in somebody's room. We'd have 8 or 10 of us in there just sitting around telling stories. And one story would feed somebody else, and they'd think of something, and that would lead to another story. I mean, it was just unbelievable. It was the most fun we ever had. And Ole got up to leave, and I got up and to see him out. And as we were walking out of the parking lot, he says, you know, we ought to write a book. Well, you could have knocked me over with a feather. In fact, I know I didn't do an interview with Ole Anderson and Whatever Happened To, because I had never considered interviewing him, really, because he would probably be one of the last people, even though I had a good rapport, you know, with wrestlers, and I could talk to them about anything, and they tell me anything. Ole was one of those guys that you just think, I'd be afraid to ask him something because he'd probably bite my head off. You know, it's, you know, something about the wrestling business. But he actually mentioned it to me. I said, sure, that sounds good. Well, I sort of just shrugged it off, and I didn't know if he was serious. And I waited about 6 months, and then he called. We talked fairly often, and one day he says, when are we going to get on that book? And I said, well, if you want to get started, we'll get started. So that's where all that came from, and we ended up doing about, I guess I spent, recorded about 40, 50 hours asking him questions and him telling me stories and answering my questions. And then I just worked all that together and, you know, into the book. And that's where the book Inside Out came.
Yeah, it's a tremendous book. Ole Anderson, Inside Out, How Corporate America Destroyed Professional Wrestling. Again, available at crowbarpress.com. We do want to talk to you about your current releases, your three most current. The first one I want to talk to you about is one that ended up being a topic here on the show, which was the Wrestling Archive Project, Classic 20th Century Matt Memories. And of course, you know, you have a 117-page, never-before-published interview with Buddy Colt, as well as various other interviews, some of which I believe originally were from Whatever Happened To. And the one that really became a big topic here on the show was a few weeks back, Bo James had released on his podcast audio of Mario Galento in 1974 going on Memphis radio after the incident that had occurred between him and Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Lawler and exposing the business. And in discussing that, I ended up digging through my old Whatever Happened To's, where you had an interview with Smokey Galento, as well as various wrestlers' remembrances of Mario Galento. And something that reminded me of something I hadn't thought about in years, and I dug it up, and on the air we discussed your interview with Dandy Jack Donovan, which discussed his... the only way to call it is a locker room assault at the hands of Jerry Jarrett and Jackie Fargo and Toji Yamamoto, a story that is later backed up a few issues later in a letter from Len and Joe Rossi. You being the person interviewing Jack Donovan, what are you thinking when he's telling you this story? Had you heard it before? What did you know about it before that time?
I knew there had been some problems, but I didn't really know the details. I had heard the Mario Galanto story from quite a few people. But the Jack Donovan story, I just knew that something had happened. Of course, Jack went into detail in the interview. In fact, that interview itself is in that Wrestling Archive project, the first volume that you just talked about with a Buddy Colt interview.
Right.
And that's in the book. It really didn't surprise me. I've had people since then that have written say they just it just blows their mind that something like that would actually take place. Because I mean, it was a people will have to read the interview to understand it, but it was a brutal attack on Jack by Tojo, Jerry, and Fargo, and I don't know exactly how much Fargo really had to do with it. I think he was along for the ride, but I don't necessarily think he participated probably as much as the others. I don't know for sure, but that's what I've had people tell me. But it was a brutal attack, and something you just would never think. I mean, it's really people talk about the assault, Sid Vicious, and was it Arn Anderson?
Yes, in England, yeah.
Yes. That wasn't any that wasn't any worse than what they were tried to do to Jack Donovan, because Jack, it was pretty brutal. But I wish Jack was here now, because I'd love to get him here talking to you about it, because he'd tell you everything. But, it's quite shocking. But I've been around the wrestling business long enough to know there was a lot of stuff like that going on. I mean, some of it in the ring, breaking people's arms or ankles or, things like that happen quite often. And Well, Jack showed respect, but a lot of times when that happened, those kind of things happened, it was because somebody didn't show, respect to one of the wrestlers or to the business, and that's why those things happened.
In terms of Mario Galanto, you had the interview with Smokey Galanto, and then you also had various wrestlers, Dick Steinborn and maybe Frankie Kane, who had stories about Mario Galanto. And I believe you said that, coming up soon would be you were going to talk to all the different parties to get the story of everything that happened in the live fight on Memphis TV, as well as the second attempted attack where he went after Jerry Lawler with a straight razor, which was broken up by Jim White sticking a gun in his mouth. I don't think you ever printed that story. Was it something you worked on and it didn't fit, or what happened with that?
Oh no, it would have fit. Something like that, I would have loved to have done. But I guess what the problem was, there weren't enough people that really knew many details that were exact, were there at the time, and so I never really did get an opportunity to talk. Plus, it's working a full time job, and I was trying to put out that magazine, work my regular job, and I just never really got around to it, I guess. I talked to Billy Wicks a few weeks ago, and I told him I want to talk to him about it, because I do plan to update that Smokey Boyette or Smokey Galanto interview. I talked to her last couple years ago, and she's willing to do it. So I may be able to, maybe getting some more information from her. Hopefully, we'll get it updated a little bit. I know Jerry Jarrett, he talked about it in his book a little bit. Of course, that's from his viewpoint. Yeah. Smokey's is from her viewpoint. Same with the Jack Donovan thing. That was his viewpoint. So who knows what the real truth is about everything.
Well, we talk about the Wrestling Archive Project, Volume 1, which, again, has the 117-page interview with Buddy Colt, as well as various interviews, including the Dandy Jack Donovan interview that we're referencing here. Another book, the one that me and Jim Cornette were very excited about, that I have in my hands right now, is your recent re-release of Whatever Happened to Gorgeous George, which is a legendary book. Other than Fall Guys, I guess it was the first real big book to break kayfabe and tell, what was going on behind the scenes. What made you decide to revisit this book and put it out?
those kind of books to me need to be out there. Same with Fall Guys. I've sort of got something on the table with that that I may end up re-releasing that, but it's going to be more of a several historians chiming in on, you know, filling everybody in on what was true, what wasn't. Because there's a lot of things in there that was plain out fabrications by Toots Mott. You know, Toots Mott had the ear of Marcus Griffin, who wrote it. So there's a lot of things in there that aren't true, things that, you know, facts that, that aren't exactly the way they happened. And so there's several of us who are going to sort of combine, do almost how they do books and they do something called an annotated version, I believe it is. I used to remember reading a book once like where they, you know, you have illustrations and explanations of things between paragraphs. That's what I want to do with that, with the Fall Guys. But as far as the Whatever Happened to Gorgeous George, I, be honest with you, I can't remember how I got in touch with Joe Jarrus, whether he contacted me. I think about that now, and I just don't remember. I'd have to ask him. But some way I got in touch with him, and I thought, you know, this would be a great project. And so, of course, my thought on all these re-releases is not only to just re-release the original book, but to add to it, to do an interview with the author. And that's what I did. I interviewed Joe, talked to him about the book and how he came about writing it, whether he had problems, you know, from the wrestlers. Did the wrestlers give him any heat about, you know, because it doesn't really come out expose the business like a lot of books, but it does some a little bit. And I just asking questions about what happened after the publication of the book. Same thing with Hooker when I re-released Luthez's book, Hooker. Luthez and I had been friends for many years, and to me that was a book that needed to be out there. And of course that's updated too. We got, you know, hundreds of pictures in the book that weren't in the original, along with, you know, interviews with the author, interview with Lou's wife Charlie, and then a lot of stories that came from interviews I had done with Lou back in the day. We added that to the end of the book, so it's pretty much a, you know, almost a new version of the book, even though the original text is, you know, appears just as it did when Lou wrote it. But that's pretty much how the Gorgeous George book came about. I just think those kind of books need to be out there. I'd seen them online, people asking hundreds of dollars for them, and Drawing Heat is another one. You know, the Bear Man story by Jim Friedman. That's a book that needed to be out there because it's got so much good information and so much history in it. So I just contacted Jim, and there again, I don't remember how I got in touch with Jim. It may have been through Greg Oliver. But those kind of books need to be available, you know, on and on.
Yeah, Bix, you had talked to me about Drawing Heat, and both of us have a desire. That's actually one of the few books I don't have, and you said also you wanted. And there was another book that Scott recently put out that you said that you were really interested in reading.
Which, oh, of the new ones? Oh, the Mark Fleming book?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting one to me. Yeah, I haven't picked it up yet. I didn't check to look at. Is it on Kindle yet, or are you just doing it on the hard copy right now?
I have got to get that. I'm trying to finish right now. I'm at the layout stage of a book called, well, I don't know. We don't have really a title yet. We haven't decided for sure, but it's the biography of Dick the Bruiser by Richard Vycheck. Wonderful.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
He did some research. I mean, did a lot of work, archives. He went to the Notre Dame Library. He's talked to everybody he could find who knew Bruiser, who wrestled Bruiser, who worked with Bruiser. He talked with Wilbur Snyder's son. You just wouldn't believe how many people have, you know, contributed to the book through their memories. Dick the Bruiser Jr. shared a lot of things from his records that he had of Bruisers. Chris Parsons of the, you know, that does the Wrestling Relics website, he helped a whole lot with pictures and information. It's going to be an awesome book. But anyway, I digress. That's what I'm working on. And the reason I brought that up was I haven't had time to get the Kindle formatted, coded correctly until I finish this. As soon as I finish this, I'll be putting the Bruiser book, Mark Fleming's book, Wrestling Archive Project, and Whatever Happened to Gorgeous George on Kindle. So I would expect within a week, 2 weeks, I'll have it up and ready to go.
Yeah, and by the way, I mean, I think it was kind of under the radar when most of the Crowbar stuff went up on Kindle, because I didn't see a lot of people talking about it, and it's been a little bit, little while now, but for those who don't realize, I mean, it's been, what, like a year, 2 years or so now that the books have been up on Kindle?
Probably a year. I'm one of these old school guys that just fought the electronic age. I love having a book in my hands, and to me, it's like I talk to my mom. She even reads Kindle now, and she likes it. She still prefers the regular books, but she reads Kindle all the time because it's so much easier. But she told me a few weeks ago, I was talking to her, and she says, funny thing is, she's reading the page on Kindle, and she reaches over to the right and tries to turn the page.
So yeah, with Mark Fleming, I mean, that's someone that maybe the average fan, even into older wrestling, wouldn't necessarily think of at first glance as someone they'd find interesting, but he has a really, like, uniquely varied career, you know, doing jobs and working undercards for Crockett, going to UW, then going to UWFI, which is very different, but also helping Luthez with his school. I mean, so since I haven't picked it up yet, and for people listening, I mean, what should we expect from that book?
Mark's book, I had somebody recently posted on Facebook, he wrote, Mark Fleming, who's he to get a book? And I thought, give me a break. It aggravates me that people show no respect, you know. And the guy's a good guy that said that. It's just the way it came across. Mark is one of these guys, and I have another book I'll reference as well by Hal West, Harold West, Duke West. He wrote a book called Long Days and Short Pays. I'll get back to Mark in a second, but Duke, his biggest claim to fame was wrestling one time for Vern Gagne on Vern's TV show. Everything else was small, little independent shows that you've probably never even heard about in Ohio, Indiana, just real tiny shows. And I say that, you know, I love Duke, but because he'll admit it. He says the same thing. You know, he was just a carpenter guy that traveled the independent circuit. But his story just, it fascinated me because it comes from a different viewpoint. You know, it comes from a viewpoint of a guy that, you know, loved the business. He had a dream, and he was able to be a part of the business, but it was nothing more than small independents, you know, traveling around. Of course, now it's hard to even find, you know, independents to do that with, you know, where you can travel around. But he traveled around a little bit, and the same with Mark Fleming. He wrestled for WCW, and in the book he talks about being trained, not trained, but going through the training camp, the school, where they weed all the wannabes out. So I think there was 27 guys with him, and Gene and Ole Anderson ran them through the paces. And one by one, these guys dropped out, left. Some of them left crying. You know, Ole put a hold on them. Gene had put a hold on them, and they couldn't take it. But Mark, you know, it's like you say, he worked with Luthez and Luthez's school. He wrestled for UWFI. He wrestled for United Nations Wrestling in Japan. And just his story, no, he wasn't a big name. He wasn't a guy that most fans would readily even recognize his name. But he has it's an interesting story. It's sort of just a side of the business, you know, that you don't always hear. You read Ric Flair stories, you read Jerry Lawler's story, you know, all these guys that have written books. And, you know, they all come from pretty much the same place. You know, they were ended up in the main events, but these guys were, you know, down in the ditches. You know, they were fighting just to have a spot. That's something interesting that I found. Mark was talking about Crockett sending them to Kansas City to wrestle when they took over the Kansas City territory, and that was sort of fascinating to read the things that happened and how that territory had pretty much died, and no matter what they did, they just couldn't bring it back. Partly because, you know, the talent that Crockett was sending, he really wasn't doing what they should do to really make it work, but it gave him an opportunity to work in a place, in a territory, and, you know, learn a little bit more about his craft.
Well, you know, speaking of interesting stories, I do want to talk to you a little bit about your early days of the business. As you mentioned previously, earlier here in this interview, you grew up in Florida, and you actually started with, I don't know if you would call it a newsletter or a fanzine in Florida. Was it something you just did on your own? Was it something where you actually were able to establish a relationship with the Cowboy Luttrell and later Eddie Graham office? Or tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, no, I didn't have any relationship with that office at all. And knowing what I know now, I didn't know this back in the day, but knowing what I know now, I am so glad I never went down to the Sportatorium and told them I wanted to do something in wrestling, because heard horror stories about that place. No, I started watching, as I said, in 1968 and was absolutely hooked. I was at a girl's house for dinner. And after dinner, she says, everybody gets up and starts going out. I said, where's everybody going? She says, we're going out to watch wrestling. I said, wrestling? And they did this every Sunday. That was what they did at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. We went out and watched it, and I was hooked from then on. And just almost immediately, I started watching the program every week, and I started checking the newspaper to see who was wrestling in Tampa. Then I went to a music camp up at Florida State. It was a six-week program, and I went to the matches there live. That was my first time I ever went to a wrestling match live at the Tallahassee Armory. And I noticed they had these posters on gas stations and store windows, and so I started asking if I could have the posters when the cards were over, and so I got a bunch of those. And by the time I guess that wasn't 4 or 5 weeks since I'd seen my first match. So Tallahassee, I realized that there was wrestling in more places than just Tampa, which I didn't know it until I went to Tallahassee. I thought they wrestled in Tampa. That was it. Come to find out, they wrestle in, 10, 12, 13 different places than just in Florida.
Yeah.
And so when I got home, I started looking at newspapers, and then I went to the library to look in out-of-town newspapers, and I went to a place called Sharp's Drugstore in Bradenton, Florida. They had the Charlotte paper, the Washington paper, papers from all over the country, and I'd look in there and read the results and see the ads and I went down there all the time. And next thing, I was going to the library up in Tampa. Somehow I found out about microfilm. And I started researching old wrestling cards. And then I found, at the same time, I had found the magazines on the newsstand. And I wrote a letter to Wrestling Review, the first thing I ever had published anywhere. And it's something about, why don't you cover Florida wrestling more, which I understand now because Bruno and those guys were the guys that sold the magazines. But I started taking a camera to the matches. I bought a camera. And started taking a camera and took pictures and started sending them into the magazines. And that's pretty much how I got my start. And I met a few of the wrestlers while I was down there. I didn't have anything to do, though, with the office. I didn't hardly talk to anybody all those, about 5 years, 6 years, I guess, that I took pictures. And I didn't want to be around. I knew enough to not get around where somebody would say, hey, kid, get out of here. We don't want you here. So I just sort of kept to myself, and I went to the matches every week at Robart Sports Stadium in Sarasota, every other week in Tampa, went to St. Pete Bayfront Center, and like I said, all that time, pretty much kept to myself. But I met enough guys and made enough relationships that the wrestlers would buy pictures from me. Then when I came up to Tennessee, I did the same thing. I just went to the matches and took pictures and wrote stories and met a few of the guys. And then one day Don Green called me and he asked me if I'd like to go to Huntsville with him. I said, sure. So I rode down to Huntsville. They had a big, big show at the Von Braun Civic Center. And I just stood out in the arena, taking pictures and doing my thing. And then somebody walks up and says, Nick Gulas wants to see you in the back. And I thought, and this is why I didn't ever get around, Eddie Graham or anything, because I thought, they're going to, if they see me, they may not want me around and kick my butt out, say, we don't want you here. And I thought I was in trouble. I had no idea. And I got to the back, and man, this guy, Nick, was so nice. He says he had heard about me from guys that were wrestling there that I'd known in Florida or that I'd met there, and he wanted to know if I'd come to work for him. And next thing I know, I'm doing all this picture, all this photography work, and then I picked up the Huntsville program. George Gulas asked me if I'd like to do the program for Huntsville. he said they used to have one there. And, of course, they had programs already in Birmingham, Chattanooga, Nashville, and or not Chattanooga. I don't guess they did have one. But I said, well, sure. So I came up with a program. We called it the Slammogram. And after about 10 weeks, the guy in Nashville who had the program, Mike Duncan, came and asked me if I'd like to buy the rights to publish the program there in Nashville. And I said, sure. So I paid him whatever it was, $500-$600, I think. He just didn't want to do it anymore. So at that point, I had the arena programs in Nashville, Huntsville, Bowling Green, and then Chattanooga. And Chattanooga was the best of all the towns. I sold more programs there than any of the other towns. But I was living a dream. I mean, doing what I, you know, being able to be a part of the pro wrestling business and people, well, just go on. I sold souvenirs. Boyd Pierce out of Louisiana, he had all kinds of gimmicks, ashtrays, pencils, pens, combs, you name it, with the Wrestling King of Sports on the side. And if you could print Wrestling King of Sports on something, he had it. And so he'd sell them to me at a 50% discount, and then I'd mark them up 50% and sell them at the wrestling matches. But the great thing about all this, the story that I always like to tell, I was making as much as a lot of the guys wrestling there at the time, between all, selling the programs every week. And I only had to go out of town 2 to 3 times a week, or actually once. Went to Chattanooga every week, went TV in Chattanooga and the house show that night. Sometimes I went to Bowling Green. But I was doing pretty well, probably $300-$500 a week between that and all the souvenirs. And it was a part-time thing because I was going to college. But I'll ask you this. Nick Gulas has such a bad reputation with people for being so chintzy and so miserly. How much, what kind of percentage do you think he asked that I had to give him for all that stuff I sold?
Ooh, the fact that you're asking it in that way makes me think I should maybe modify what my answer would have been. you know, I don't want to say 0%, but let's say 15%.
I bet people say, yeah, he probably took half of what you got, you know, or some people say 25%. Well, you're too high. He never asked me for one dime.
Wow.
He says, Scott, you give me good publicity. He says, whatever you make, you can keep. And he allowed me to set up a table in the foyer of all the arena, any arena I wanted, and sell all those gimmicks. He allowed me to go and sell programs and have people sell programs at all those places. All I had to do was go to the office once a week, sit down with the booking when they were booking, and find out what, and they'd tell me what they had planned coming up. So I knew what kind of stuff, you know, what kind of articles to write for the program. You know, if we're going to be pushing Randy Savage next week or blah, blah, blah. And so I do an article on Randy Savage or, you know, one thing or another like that. And but he never charged me one dime. I made a great living while I was in college, paid my way through college. And, you know, it gave me a good start in life. It taught me a lot about business and life. And, of course, I also sold pictures. The wrestlers bought pictures from me. So I had a great deal. And I have nothing but good things to say about Nick Gulas. And there's a lot of guys who don't say good things, but at the same time, there's a lot of guys who made a great living with Nick Gulas, some of whom would never be able to wrestle anywhere else. They never would have been given an opportunity. And some guys like Tommy Rich, what he got an opportunity through Nick. I would almost bet he never would have gotten in the door if he had gone straight to Ole Anderson.
Yeah, but I would say so, yeah.
Right. He got a good start with Nick Gulas, and Tommy was so talented, you know. But by Nick and Jerry giving him that start, you know, Jerry Jarrett had a good bit to do with that too, you know, with Tommy. But by the opportunity of being able to wrestle in that territory, Tommy, look what, you know, where Tommy went. You know, he had a great, great career.
Yeah, and, you know, your story is so similar to that of Jim Cornette's in terms of he ended up doing for Jarrett what you did for Gulas, doing the programs and the pictures and having a gimmick table and all that. And similar story too, where he was making more money than most of the wrestlers, you know, a lot of the time.
He took a pay cut to become a manager, significant pay cut.
That's right.
Yeah, I heard a story one time. I forget when it, whether I heard it after I got out of the business or while I was in it, but it may have been Cowboy Frankie Lane told me. He said that Jim Cornette, and I think Jim will back this up because I think he even said something to me about it, but he said he was so jealous of me because I never met him until, you know, years and years and years later, decades later. But he said he was jealous of me because everybody told him I was allowed to go in and out of the dressing room whenever I wanted. I had free access to everything. And he wasn't even allowed to go in the dressing room for years. You know, I guess until he got in the business, I guess. But I always thought that was funny.
So, that Nick Kula sounds like a heck of a guy, doesn't he?
That's the first person I've heard not just say positive things about Nicholas, but emphatically talk about what a nice guy he was to him. Not just Nick, but, you know, George Gulas as well. And, you know, Scott's a pretty straight shooter, pretty much a straight shooter. And I would say him saying that is really interesting. And, you know, the fact that he didn't take any money off those programs that he was doing for all those different towns for all those years, it says a lot. It says a lot about how much he appreciated someone who was doing something for him, too. Did you expect that? What did you expect the percent was going to be?
I wasn't sure. Like, I was thinking in my head 50-50 because I'm just thinking, like, you know, with, you know, companies that shoot indie wrestling or whatever, you know, they'll go 50-50 with the promotion these days. Yeah. So I'm in my head, I'm just like, okay, 50-50 is not entirely unreasonable. So no. That's kind of what I was thinking in my head, but wow.
Yeah, and, you know, as we said at the end there, it's just his story is so similar to Jim Cornette's when, you know, Jim Cornette was doing for Jerry Jarrett what Scott did for Nick Ulis. He did all the programs. He sold gimmicks. He had pictures. He hooked up the wrestlers with publicity shots. You know, it's very much the same story. And, you know, I don't want to leave out just, you know, I enjoyed talking to him about Crowbar Press. I'm really looking forward to that Dick the Bruiser book coming out. You know, especially if it sheds new light on his the inner workings of his territory, if it talks about the famous riot in Madison Square Garden. There's just so many great stories that could be in there. And Scott seemed to indicate it was really well researched. So that should be coming anytime soon. You could go to, as we said in the interview, crowbarpress.com. And if you purchase anything from there, just let them know. Send them if you do it by PayPal, just attach a message that you heard about it here on 605. We'd really appreciate that. And of course, for the Kindle versions, what can they do, Bix?
tinyurl.com/605Amazon.
And we'll also link that in the show description on the website. So, you know, please support Scott. He's doing great work to keep wrestling's history, to preserve wrestling's history and keep the stories alive. And, you know, like I said, everything he's put out, I think, is tremendous. And next week here on the show, we're going to talk really, get a lot of stories from the inner workings of the Gulas territory. But one of the books we talk about next week, you know, going back to Jimmy Snuka, Bix, will be the Tony Atlas story, Too Much Too Soon. And you'll find out the connection to Jimmy Snuka next week here on the show in part two of the interview. I hate to call it an interview, the talk we had with Scott Teal. And again, support Scott, crowbarpress.com. He does great work.
You know what he should do for the Dick the Bruiser book? You should get Wayne St. Wayne to paint the cover.
I should send him my my Wayne St. Wayne picture, painting that I have on my wall. I reached out to Wayne. I tried to get Wayne on the show. He didn't get back to me.
Is he on Facebook? Or
he's on Facebook. Number? He has a Facebook page.
Is it under Wayne St. Wayne? Or?
It's under Wayne St. Wayne.
Okay.
And I reached out to him. I don't have his phone number now. But I did find all my old audio cassettes of my talks with him and all of his crazy stories. So I may have to get these converted to play him on there. I just found a whole bunch of audio cassettes. Great stuff. That Michael Hayes interview on Texas radio I talked about once before, and the Wayne St. Wayne talks and all my old talks with Terry Funk and just old wrestling interviews off TV and the Eddie Gilbert Memorial Brawl Bruncheon from 1996. So maybe in the upcoming episodes, it's not going to be imminent, but we'll dig into some of my audio files and get these on the air.
I'll help you find the right thing to convert those.
You're the best person for this stuff. You really are. Whatever we decide we're going to get, Bix, let's make sure we use our own Amazon link so we end up paying ourselves.
Yes.
When we purchase it. But again, Scott Teal, part two next week. I think everyone will really enjoy it. You'll get a lot of stories about working for Nick Gulas. And with that, it is time for what may be the most popular part of our show every week. Someone wrote, you know, long live the Dennis of the Week, this on Facebook. It's the Dennis of the Week, our weekly tribute to the late, great independent promoter Dennis Carluzzo, a great friend of mine and someone who is one of the most fascinating characters to ever be around professional wrestling, a fan of wrestling, and someone who did a lot of good for young guys trying to get a break in the business, and myself being one of them. And each week we talk to someone, or if we can't find someone, I blabber a little bit about Dennis Carluzzo. And this week we spoke to our reigning champion. How many times has he been on the show now? Is this the third time on the show? Third time on the show. I think he's been referenced almost every week since his first appearance. So it is the King of Kingsport, Bo James, kingofkingsport.com. He's got lots of cool stuff, including his upcoming East Tennessee wrestling history book that'll be out, but he also has some autobiographies and DVDs of continental wrestling and southeastern wrestling. Check him out. But here's Bo James, the king of Kingsport, with this week's Dennis of the Week. Joining us this week for our Dennis of the Week weekly story about Dennis Carluzzo, the late great independent promoter out in New Jersey, is the King of Kingsport and the in-house resident expert on southeastern and East Tennessee wrestling, Bo James. Bo, how you doing today?
Doing well.
So you had told me that you had a story about Dennis Carluzzo, and it's one I had never heard, so I was incredibly intrigued, and let's hear it.
Well, I'm sure most of the people that tell their Dennis stories know a lot more about Dennis than I do. I only met Dennis one time, and I only talked to him on the phone two or three times. But my friend Mike DiMuzio, who I've known for decades, and Dennis were big buddies. And, you know, I used to hear all kinds of stories. I laugh when I hear these Dennis stories because I've heard them from Mike over the years, some of them. And sometime in the mid-90s, I was using Debbie Combs on all my towns, and she was the NWA ladies champion. She had the belt. She had won the belt in the all-girl battle royal in Honolulu when Bob Guy won the real NWA was around. And she had been through here in East Tennessee as the ladies world champion. So I just called her, you know, the NWA women's champion on my advertisement. And I was using her, and she would bring different girls into work and everything. And nobody said nothing for over a year. And then this guy named Dexter Holly, that I don't know if you all even know who he is, because most people don't know. He's the guy that had Steve Corino arrested for hitting him with a chair.
Okay.
And if you don't know that story, that's another one for another day. But Dexter had bought into the NWA, and he had ideas of taking over East Tennessee. He was going to come run East Tennessee and West Virginia. And at the time, I was running East Kentucky, Southern West Virginia, Southwest Virginia, Western North Carolina, and East Tennessee. Pretty much 150 miles anywhere from my home that I thought I could make a dollar, I ran a town. So Dexter had it in his mind that he was going to take over and run. And he thought how he was going to do that was he was going to get the NWA to sue me and put me out of business. So he sends an email about all this nonsense, and I ignore it. I see him in towns, and he doesn't come anywhere near me. He stays away. So finally, one night, I'm sitting at home, and the president of the NWA calls me. And I never met the guy. I don't know him. I met him years later, and he starts complaining about me using the NWA name. She's not the champion. They currently don't have an NWA champion. We need to stop this, just all this stuff. And I said, look, she won the belt in 86. She was here in Continental. She was here afterwards. Nobody's beat her for it. She's still the champion. We don't recognize her as the champion. So it gets heated. So a couple of days later, I get a email cease and desist from them. I laugh.
Is this Howard Brody?
Yes.
Okay.
I give it to Al Getz. He puts it on the internet. This is early days of the internet. So now it really blows up to where they're all mad at me. Well, Mike Muzio had came down and refed the loop for me that week. And I was telling him about it. We were riding back from somewhere in Virginia back to my place one night, and I was telling him about it. He's, you know, laughing, and he says, well, Dennis uses Debbie, and he calls her the world's champion. I said, really? He said, yeah. So Mike, the next week, did work for Dennis or whatever, and I'm sitting at home one day, go to the mailbox, there's a package from Dennis Colarusso. I open it up, there's a tape. Three matches, I still have the tape, and I have his business card that he sent with it, the Wrestling Czar. And it has a handwritten letter that says, here's matches from Debbie as the world champion wrestling in New Jersey for me. If they come at you again, tell them to go F yourself and tell them to take this tape of her as the NWA champion and stick it up their ass.
Yep, that was Dennis.
So the next phone call that I get, and it wasn't from, I don't even remember who it was from. This one was not from Brody. Somebody else. And I said, I got a tape here that one of your NWA members mailed me, where Debbie is on NWA cards as the world champion. They said, oh, yeah, who's that? I said, Dennis Colarusso. Oh, Dennis uses her? We didn't know that. And that was the end of it. Never to be mentioned or brought up again. And, you know, and I called Dennis after I got the package. I told him, I said, thanks, you know. And he said, look, if they try to sue you, they try to do whatever, you call me back. He says, Mike, he says, you're all right with me, and I'll help you. And I met Dennis maybe 3 years after that. You know, I made a trip. He ran a show in West Virginia. And Tracy Smothers and Wolfie D come by on the way up there. They said, you want to go? I said, no. They said, what's for Dennis Colarusso? I said, I'll go, because I wanted to meet him. And that was the only meeting I had. But Dennis was the kind of guy, if you was all right with one of the people he was all right with, you was all right with him too. And, you know, he come and bailed me out. And just by mentioning his name and said, hey, I've got the evidence right here, it dropped the whole subject.
There it is, Bo James, kingofkingsport.com, with this week's Dennis of the Week. And I like the fact that he brings up, you know, a quality of Dennis, where he didn't know Dennis, he didn't have a relationship with Dennis. But Dennis saw what was going on, saw that it wasn't right, and jumped in to help him out.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. And just the way Dennis basically just told him, I mean, he said he would take care of it, but if it didn't, the video evidence, then there would be hell to pay.
Yeah, that's Dennis, all right. And we have a few cool Dennis of the Weeks in the works right now, so we won't say anything yet. But the next few weeks, well, maybe not right away, but we definitely have some cool ones that will be coming at you pretty soon.
And yes, and I did want to mention also, though, although we need to figure out exactly what time we're going to chat with him, that our buddy Dave Prazak posted on Facebook, I guess it was this past week, that it was the 20th anniversary of the first time he ever, you know, worked a wrestling show as the ring announcer for the first annual Eddie Gilbert Memorial Show for Dennis Colarusso.
Yeah, I was there. That was Cherry Hill, New Jersey. It was the weekend of the blizzard of 96, because I remember we all got to the hotel on Friday night and the snow was so bad that everything was shut down. Luckily, there was a restaurant attached to the hotel and we got to... That's where it was like me, Jim Cornette, Dennis, a few other people. And then me and Jim Cornette watched wrestling videos all night. And it was just a blast. And the next day was the bruncheon. And, you know, Doug Gilbert was there and Jim Cornette was there and Don Leibel. And everyone gave really nice speeches about Eddie, Jerry Lawler. And then in the middle of it, there was a commotion because someone walked in from the side of the room unannounced, wasn't supposed to be there. And it was Mick Foley. Cactus Jack was how we called him at that time. And Cactus Jack showed up, and he wasn't supposed to. And apparently Paul Heyman didn't want him to because it was a Dennis event. And plus, you know, Paul and Eddie had a falling out. And he gave a very nice speech about what Eddie meant to him in his career. Because, you know, independent wrestling today is so different than it was in 1991 and 1992. But Cactus and Eddie was the big independent feud.
Mm-hmm.
For a while there. I mean, that was the one when I first got into tape training. People still talked about Cactus and Eddie. And it was a feud that happened for Joel Goodhart And it was a feud that happened for Dennis Caruso, so it wasn't confined to one independent promotion.
And I'm trying to remember, when he got his tryout with the UWF right before Crockett bought it, wasn't that also through Eddie?
I think so. I'm not sure, but it would make sense that it was, because Eddie was the booker there. And I think what had happened, if I remember right, was UWF ran a show in Pittsburgh, and right. Dominic DiNucci supplied them with undercard talent. And that's where Troy Orndorff, who became Shane Douglas, was discovered. And that's when he came down there and started wrestling for UWF. And Cactus was discovered there, too, and they were going to bring him in. And then, of course, WCW or NWA, excuse me, Jim Crockett Promotions, I should say, to be specific, purchased the UWF, and Dusty got his hands on everything, and everything changed for the worse.
And also Sam Houston kind of ruined the mixed tryout.
What happened? I don't remember that story.
He sends him into the ropes and just says, "Watch the elbow."
And he watched it?
Yeah, pretty much. And the finish did not go well.
Oh, man. Oh, Sam Houston. Someone who I never was a fan of.
He was talented, but what would be the word to use? I feel like gangly would be mean.
Well, gangly was true, but I don't know. I never took him seriously. I never was a big fan of his. And then, of course, when he became the dancing cowboy in the WWF, then I really didn't want to see him anymore. But, yeah, not a big Sam Houston fan. And
I liked his run in Global, where I believe he was booked by Eddie Gilbert.
That's right. That's right. Eddie Gilbert all over the place. I have the audio cassette of that Eddie Gilbert Brunchen, as I said, and Bix and I are going to get a way to get this on the air. We're going to try to do it this month being the anniversary of the 20 years since that first time. And I remember Dave Prazek on that show because, you know, Dave, like me, was a young guy around Dennis's show. So we all kind of noticed each other and became friends with each other back then. And, okay, I think that's about it for this week. Right, Bix? Anything else you could think of on the agenda?
No, I think that's it.
All right. Well, before we get to I guess I'll let you do your plugs first before I do the show plugs.
Oh, I mean, there's not really.
Should I set should I do the timer? Should we do the challenge?
Nah, I don't think so.
You think you could do it, though? You think you can just bang them out?
I mean, there's not too much special this week. Just kind of the usual stuff. I mean, there's nothing like that I'm dying to push. You know, this week's Between the Sheets, we covered this week in 1990 with guest Tim Livingston. It was the week of the 10th Clash of the Champions with Sting blowing out his knee and Mil Máscaras versus Cactus Jack and all that good stuff.
Lots of good stuff on this episode about Tully Blanchard. For those of you who were fans of Tully and always wondered what exactly happened with the NWA, where they dropped the offer to him after he failed his drug test, and then there were still talks about him coming in. Lots of really good stuff this week on Between the Sheets about that, so you should definitely check that out.
Thanks. Yeah, because there were a few false starts. I think that's the thing. Like, even if people know about some of it, it's confusing because they drop the offer, then they bring him, then they like kind of bring him back in for further talks, then they kick him out of CNN Center, whatever the hell happened. That gets covered in depth on this week's Between the Sheets. What?
Just the idea of him and his agent being kicked out of CNN Center just cracks me up.
I had never heard that one before until I read in the Matt Watch from that week.
Yeah. Hey, Steve Beverly had good sources, too. Jim Hurd.
And I mean, that's the only real big thing on the agenda this week. You know, as always, check out Figure Four Weekly at f4wonline.com. What else do we have? I mean, you know, like I said, the usual stuff, scoops.com, MMAnews.com, Fighting Spirit Magazine. I mean, but nothing too big right this second, and might be more to talk about next week, but I think that's about it. Of course, I guess we'll plug again together the 605 Super Podcast Amazon referral link, which, if you just want to go to the Amazon main page, is tinyurl.com/605Amazon.
Yeah, and we'll have some links for specific things you can buy using the link on our – but that was a really bad sentence. There will be some specific – I'm killing myself.
On our
– there will be on our website, 605pod.com, in the show description, links for specific items. For instance, the Bret Hart book, some of the Kindle versions of the Scott Teal books, And again, you can use it for any of the purchases you make. And the website is 605pod.com. I also did want to bring up, because, you know, we would like to try to find a way to make a few bucks doing this, because we are spending a lot of our time working on the show and planning it. Plus, it'll make my girl a little more tolerant of all the time I'm spending on it. But we also have, in the description of each show, at the very bottom, we have links for Bix and myself. We have PayPal donations if you'd wish to give us a gratuity. If you like the show and would like to throw a few bucks at us, we'd certainly appreciate it. So you could do so there. It is in the bottom of the show description for this episode and every other episode. Also, I want to say, if you want to join the conversation on Twitter, Bix is at David Bix. I'm at Great Brian Last. And you could always use the hashtag 605pod. On Facebook, we are facebook.com/superpodcast. And am I getting everything? I feel like I'm forgetting something, just because now there's so much that I have to be forgetting something.
I think that's it. I don't believe you're going to be on the Jim Cornette's podcast this week.
I won't be on this week, but, you know, who knows? Maybe I'll be back on again before you know it.
So I think that's it. I don't think we have anything else to go over. So, yes, thank you all for listening. Make sure to check out all of the past episodes.
That's right. And as always, it would really do us a big favor if you would leave a positive review and write a review on iTunes for the show page. If you could leave us a 5-star review, we hope. We think we deserve it.
That's what we forgot.
Yeah, that's the one we forgot. You see, well, you didn't forget it. I forgot it.
Well, yeah, you usually do that one. I was using the royal we to take some of the pressure off of you.
Yeah, well, please write us a nice positive review. And believe it or not, it does help. And I think that's it now. Next week on the show, we will have part 2 of our interview with Scott Teal, the Dentist of the Week, and other fun things we're working on. So until next time, for David Bix, I'm the Great Brian Last saying, tally-ho! Tally-ho!
Warlord? Yes, brother? I know you like to go to that gym, and I know you like to work out, and I know you like to train that body, so get yourself in top shape for any kind of action that you get involved in. Well, brother, let me tell you something, my man. I love to get in shape myself, and I love to work out. Woof, woof, woof.